And now, Forward with Falk. Join Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen as they navigate their way through the political thicket. Well, I suppose, Dave, that you can't argue that the big news of the political news of the week was really policy news, and that was the debt deal, or the deal about the debt, or the deal about raising the debt ceiling. But that has political implications, and it is deeply political, even though it's a policy matter. What did you think of that?
Well, there's several ways to look at it. The first way is, some people said, why didn't the Democrats do something about this before they lost control of the Congress?
Okay, why didn't they? That's a good question.
And that is a good question. You know, they had the vote when they had, when Pelosi was still there as Speaker and they had the House, they could have done this now.
But maybe they didn't have the Senate. They had the Senate, but they had the Senate with Sinema and Manchin. That's not really like they had the Senate.
Well, but at least they could try.
They could try.
Pressure on these folks.
That's
true. I think what happened is, I think that they didn't believe that the Republicans would be as despicable as they were.
Well, how could they not believe that?
I know that. You know, there's no bottom to what they will or won't do. But, you know, they said, well, they kept raising it when Trump was president. They had control of the Congress, so why wouldn't they do it?
Because Trump gave them the answer when they asked them, when they said, you were for raising it when you were the president. Why are you against raising it now? And Trump said, well, now I'm not the president.
President, yeah.
Right. He was honest. He told the truth.
That's, yeah, one of the few times.
Yeah.
But he did that. You know, and the other thing was, you know, the pressure that was where it was coming from and behind the scenes that people didn't see. You know, certainly Wall Street, the corporate people that sponsor the Republican Party didn't want a debt crisis. But they didn't lean
on the Republicans.
You know, what those folks have forgotten, you know, is that that's no longer a full winning strategy in the Republican Party. That the crazies in the Republican Party don't care about corporate America that much. They have their own base. They have their own way of raising money, and they believe that in destroying things rather than building things, that it works to their advantage. And so what you saw was that there's...
So wait a minute, let me interrupt you. So you're that's an interesting point you're making. You're saying that the MAGA people, whose policy, insofar as they have a policy, is the corporate policy, are not bound together by allegiance to the corporate policy. That's not what keeps them as a movement, although that's what they do as a movement. But what keeps them as a movement is their racism and their contempt for working people and their general brutishness. But they do that to get themselves in power so that they, and when they're in power, insofar as they have a policy, they carry out the corporate policy. But they don't depend on the corporations to get into power. That's your point?
Right.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and to the extent that they do the corporate bidding, it's almost tangential. You know, it's part of the DNA that they have.
But what that describes is the classic fascist party. That's precisely how Hitler came to power.
Well, yeah. And well, when Hitler came to power, the corporate elites thought that they can control him.
That's right. But he didn't. But in the end, he didn't depend on them.
That's
he
correct.
Carried out policies beneficial to them. That was his policy.
But they fell in line.
They fell in line because they could see that that's where their bread was buttered.
Yeah, I.G. Farben fell in line.
Yeah. Well, even DuPont in America fell in line.
Fell in line, or IBM fell in line.
That's right.
But anyhow, there were 70 Republicans who voted against the deal.
These are MAGA types, right? These were all the MAGA types.
Pretty much. And there were 46 Democrats who voted against the deal.
In the House or in the Senate?
In the House.
In the House.
In the House, mostly on the progressive side, or the very progressive side.
Well, Scott Perry voted against it. He's not progressive.
No, but he was one of the Republicans that voted against it.
Yeah,
and but in Pennsylvania, Summer Lee, who's probably the most progressive member of the House, voted against it.
Interesting enough, Ilhan Omar voted for it.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of split people. You know, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert aren't always on the same side.
Well, Lauren Boebert abstained. She didn't vote either way.
Yeah, she said she was going to vote no, and then she didn't show, which isn't
true. Well, she's a person of character and conscience.
Well, she is a character.
Yeah.
In that. Now, I just want to, as an aside, I was at a fundraiser for Matt Cartwright this week, our congressman, and one of the points he made...
My congressman.
One of the points he made right up the front was that there's more bipartisanship in Congress than people read about in the papers or see in the news or listen to. And to some extent, I mean, this thing passed the House with over 300 votes, which in today's world is an enormous amount of bipartisanship. And then got 63 votes in the Senate. Our new senator, Fetterman, voted against it. Our senior senator, Casey, voted for it. Part of that, I think, is the fact of who's running in 2024 and who isn't, although I think Bob Casey would have voted for this regardless. Fetterman, if there's any blowback to this vote, it will long be forgotten by the time he has to run again in 2026. So we had that that vote, and at least the Biden administration is saying, look, chalk another one up to our theory of governance that we can deliver bipartisan legislation that's good for the country. And, you know, there's a whole host of things that they've done in a bipartisan manner. You know, we could go through the whole list of the bills that they've passed throughout, which is a pretty, you know, good list, and a growing, you know, it's grown as a list. So to that extent, it fulfills the Biden image, so to speak. Now, on the other hand, there was a downside to this, and just negotiating the way it was negotiated, that it got tied to the hostage taking of the Republicans on the debt ceiling to cut benefits in certain ways. But the cuts were, you know, somewhat muted. Although if you were one of the ones that got cut, it certainly wasn't. But what the Republicans wanted, where they started, and what they wound up with, was far less. So that's what we had there.
Well, but that's very important, because the people who were targeted by the Republicans for paying for the Trump tax cuts and for making up what they say is the shortfall and the crisis and the debt were all working people. They were all people on Medicaid or on food stamps. So people on food stamps, a third of whom are children, they're the ones whose benefits should be cut so that the corporations and the top 1% could get that gigantic tax cut. That's what paid for it.
Well, that's
their morality. That's family values.
Well, that was Fetterman's reason for voting against it, that it was would take money from SNAP.
Yeah. So the Biden argument is, well, that's true, but we'll get other people involved in it that are not now eligible. But that doesn't say anything for the people who lost their benefit. They're still going to go hungry.
Well, you had that work requirement that was extended by a few years. It was it's going to be put in not all at once, but it's going to be 2 years and then over 50, and then 4 years ultimately. The thing is that there were never tax increases for the wealthy on the table. Those things never were there to bounce off. And we know that if you're worried about the deficits, you're worried about the debt, that the only way to make that up is to do tax increases on those who best can pay for them and who have benefited mostly from the tax cuts of, the last numerous decades since Ronald Reagan took office.
Exactly. But,
Reagan cut taxes mostly for the top, and he ballooned the deficit. He actually had to increase some taxes. W took a surplus, gave big tax cuts to the wealthy, and created a huge deficit. And Trump, had a tax cut, was mostly for the wealthy.
Right.
Matter of fact, he went down to Mar-a-Lago and said, look, I just gave you a 40% tax cut. He also gave himself a 40% tax cut.
Yeah.
And, of course, then he increased the national debt by 25%.
Right. But let me get into this business with the national debt, because I think there's a lot of nonsense that's used by the Republicans to obscure what's really going on. They talk about the rising national debt and how much they're not looking at the right thing. They're not letting you look at the right thing. I want to compare it to what most people know. Most people have a mortgage. The average mortgage in America is $313,000. That's the average mortgage, according to the people who give mortgages. The average salary in America, yearly salary, is $57,000. So, I don't know, roughly, what, five times the average mortgage, right?
Yeah. One-fifth the average mortgage.
Huh? Well, if it's $60,000, let's assume it's $60,000 is the average salary, and $330,000 is the average mortgage, five times 60 is 300, right?
Yeah, but you said that the income was five times the mortgage. No,
just the other way. The mortgage is five times the income. That's right.
Right.
But that doesn't bother you. That's not your concern. Your concern is how much do you have to pay each month to carry your mortgage. That's what determines whether the mortgage is out of sight. And when you go to make a mortgage, they don't ask you anything other than what percentage of your income are you going to have to spend on housing? In other words, it's the carry that matters. The monthly carry for the average mortgage is about $1,100 for every mortgage holder on a $60,000, income. Now,
what's in America, $12,000 to $14,000.
Yeah, $12,000 to $14,000. That's right, on $60,000.
About 20-some percent.
20-some percent. The carry, the net interest cost to the federal government of the current debt is 1.9%. Not 20%. 1.9%. It's gone 2 years ago, 3 years ago, it was 3-point-something percent, 3.5%. The carry doesn't count. It's irrelevant. There is no debt crisis, and it's certainly not an exploding debt crisis. And people should know that.
Well, the thing, though, and why maybe mortgages are more easily understood by the average person but may not be the most appropriate way to look at things is when we're talking about mortgage and the carry on the mortgage, you're not just paying off the interest. You're also decreasing the amount you owe.
Which doesn't happen with the debt.
That's correct. It doesn't.
But in the first 7 years of your mortgage, you don't pay off any principal. You pay off
only. You pay off very little principal.
Right.
You pay off very little principal.
That's right.
Most of it goes on. Yeah. And that's the point. On the other hand, what the average person doesn't have is the ability to print money that the government has.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
And the responsibility of the government to do other things is so much greater that requires spending money, defense and all the agencies that are part of the government that make our country work. You want to have roads? Well, you have to build roads. You have to maintain them. You want to fly on vacation? You have to have an air traffic control system. You want to have safe food? You have to have an FDA. You get sick, you have to have some way of making sure that the medications and the medicines are safe and effective, and also that...
Yeah, in other words, you got to run society.
Yeah, you got to run society.
Things they don't want to do that. They don't believe in doing that. Or they want to run it to their own benefit, but to not the benefit of the people who live, the majority of the people who live in the society.
Right.
That comes to the business with work requirements. Why do they want work requirements? What's the big deal here, work requirements? Because they believe that poverty is a cultural matter, or is a moral matter. You're poor because you want to be poor. You're a layabout. You'd rather sit on the couch, collect government benefits, right?
Right. It's a philosophy.
It's a philosophy. That's exactly right. But and they've had work benefits, the work requirements. The fact is that everybody who studied work requirements, what are the result of work requirements, you discover that, first of all, the people who are forced into subjected to the work requirements don't get stable work. It's not available to them. And secondly, the large majority of individuals subject to work requirements remain poor and become poorer. So where's the benefit? Who benefits?
Well, you know, there's a structural nature to poverty that this, you know, the work requirements doesn't cure.
No, it doesn't tackle.
Well, and like someone said, you know, when we bailed out the banks, we didn't put a work requirement on the banks. You know, it's only on, you know, the individuals that we look down on this, or that we put these requirements. These parts of the law in there, and you know, that's sort of the as you said, that's just the how they view morality on this stuff. You know, and some of these members of Congress who were saying, you know, or this week the Congress voted against forgiving student loans, again for basically the same reason: you have to be responsible for your debt. And some of those congressmen who are voting, against this forgiveness, took huge PPP loan forgiveness. They took out huge PPP loans and they forgave them.
Or corporations. And by the way, a lot of those people took those loans. All of those loans were intended to make payroll. So the whole argument for the loans was, well, people will be kept at work. It's going to benefit workers. They didn't do that. Most of them kept the money and used it for all other purposes, but not for payroll. They laid people off anyway.
Well, that's why some of them have gotten sued by the government.
Yeah.
In order to claw back these benefits.
And one of the people who did this and is not getting sued by the government was Lauren Boebert.
Yeah.
She took the money and closed her restaurant.
who didn't show up for the vote. On the deal this week, despite being very, very vociferous about it, about voting against it.
Right. Well.
So, you know, we'll just have to see how this plays out.
They claim that they're going to save, that they're doing this to save money, right? That's the big deal. They're going to save money. So you cut people off food stamps, first of all, because these people don't deserve to eat, and second of all, because you're going to save money. And it turns out that they spend more money enforcing the work requirement than they would have spent if they'd given out the food stamps to begin with.
Well, another part that was not cost effective was, you know, the Republicans have been against funding the IRS, and that previously the Democrats had pushed through over $80 billion in over 10 years in new funding for the IRS to make services better. So when people call on the phone, they get it answered. And two, to update the equipment, and three, to hire new agents who will primarily go after the wealthy, who are the ones that use complicated tax schemes in order to avoid paying taxes. And what they've done is they were successful in getting $20 billion of that clawed back and removed from funding of the IRS. The thing is,
was an investment, because the amount of money that they were projected to collect from the deadbeats who were avoiding their taxes was like five times the $80
billion. Right. So you couldn't justify that on economics, but it's the optics of it that they wanted, you know, and the Republican Party, which is funded by the multimillionaires and the billionaires, wanted to do their bidding on this. And so there'll be that's another thing that doesn't quite make sense, but was part of the give and take in the deal. It was part of the give and take.
They made a deal. What the Democrats didn't do as part of the deal, and Biden is proud of the fact that he made this deal, and he basically got what he was hoping to get, and what he thought he would get even if he was negotiating in the future over the appropriations. He felt that he could justify what he did because the net result was the same. And he may be right.
And he got this push beyond the 2024 election.
He got everything he wanted, exactly. But that's only one aspect. That's the aspect of management of the economy, management of the government, management of the society. There's another aspect to the leader of the Democratic Party that this doesn't approach, and that is you're supposed to inspire and motivate the base. That's very important. Biden doesn't do that. He may have gotten everything he wanted, but in my view, that demoralized the base. Because he said he wasn't going to do any of that stuff. He wasn't going to negotiate. It was he was after a clean raising of the debt limit. He didn't do that. He didn't think he would be able to do that, but he didn't say to the people what the truth is. Had he told people, listen, here's what we're going to have to get away with. Here's what we're going to have to do. Here's how I'm going to try to do it. Then he could have said, well, you see, we had a successful negotiation. We did what we thought we could do. We can go forward. He said he was going to do something else altogether, which he knew he wasn't going to do. To me, the average person seeing that gets alienated from politics, gets alienated from the thought that you can really do something, even though Biden got what he wanted. In other words, he did not do part of the job.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm not sure debt limits is a motivating factor. The people I understand what you're saying, you know, in terms of doing what you say you're going to do. But as far as issues are motivating, I think they're far more important issues to motivate the base. And we're just going to have to see how that plays out in the next year. In that respect.
Well, the thing to me that motivates the base is, are you making an argument for restoring to working people the right to hope for an equal chance within your society? That's what the New Deal offered. That was the whole point of the Roosevelt Coalition. That was why Roosevelt was worshipped by working people, because Roosevelt's New Deal said, forget, we're going to lift you out of, you're going to get lifted out of poverty. You're going to organize yourself. You're going to have decent working conditions. You're going to get what you earn. What you created, you're going to get a fair share. And there was a whole vision of wiping out inequality as the point of the social safety net. This is not the social safety net portrayal that we get from today's Democrats. Today's Democrats portray the social safety net in terms of austerity. And how can we get along with, how can we cope with austerity and do the best we can when there's no reason for austerity at all? It's a whole different approach to posing the political issue. The came into the Democrats post-World War II. It came with, I think, with Clinton, really, the Democratic Leadership Council, of which Biden was a part. They don't make the case to working people. They don't have the same vision of the role of labor within the Democratic coalition that the Roosevelt coalition had. And that's the problem to me.
Well, the other problem was the way that they were structured. I've been reading pieces about the fact that the Democrats still are top down rather than the bottom up party. And that they have, I think they've slowly started to learn this. I mean, the bottom-up guy was Howard Dean, and he was very successful in that. I was reading this week in the context of a couple of states where the parties decided that they would take back the legislature and they would work from the bottom up. And you had Michigan and Minnesota where that happened. And in Minnesota, from what I understand, they have a very narrow majority in the legislature, but they've passed like 90% of what they wanted to pass in a very short time because they grabbed control and they're working on it. Michigan, the same way, they've passed a number of popular items because they were able to now have both houses of the legislature and the governorship. And that's what really needs to happen. You know, they lost that in Wisconsin. They lost that in North Carolina. And Florida was a debacle for them over the last couple of election cycles. Now, I understand they're going to be trying to reconstruct their party down in Florida, but they have a long way to go. DeSantis won re-election by an overwhelming amount. He won it even in Democratic areas, but the fact of the matter is a lot of Democrats stayed home. And that goes to somewhat of what you're saying. You have to give people a reason to come out.
You have to have
somebody that they want to vote for, and you have to have policies that they want to vote for.
That's the key. And you got to make propaganda for the policy. You got to win people to support the policy and to take action for the policy. That's exactly right. You can't look at politics like you're selling Coca-Cola, that it's all branding, that it's all atomized individual stuff. We're not atoms. We're part of society.
We're molecules.
That's right. That's exactly right. We may not be like bees in a swarm, but we do work in, we are organizing society into interest groups. And the vast majority of the interest group people are in one group, working people. And if their demands are not reflected in the political programs of political parties, as individuals, they won't find any reason to support those political parties. And that's shown by these votes.
Well, that's called inspiration. You have to inspire people.
That's my point. That's inspiration.
Inspiration, aspiration.
And, you know, on the other side, the reactionaries, they give you a lot of stuff to work with. Look at the book burning, bannings.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, Utah, this week, some guy in Utah, or school board in Utah, did absolutely the most phenomenal thing. They banned the Bible.
Because somebody went there and said, hey, look, you're complaining about all these sexual things that are going on in society and all this violence and whatever. Well, here's the book that has plenty of that.
Right. And they couldn't get away from it. So they banned the Bible. And what did one guy say? It was worth it because we were able to continue banning the other books. But you're only banning the other books because, according to you, they violate what the Bible says. So how come you could ban the Bible? It's berserk. When you have people who are so berserk, you ought to be able to beat them.
Yeah. As I've said many times, it's a target-rich environment.
It's a target-rich environment. Well, that's it for this week. Next week, we'll have other stuff. We'll have more people joining the Republican primaries. God knows what we'll have.
More targets.
More targets. More targets. And hopefully a chance for Democrats to figure out how to represent working people. Because that's their task. Because if mass democracy means working people have to participate one way or the other. And the MAGA approach to it is fool the workers. And they'll support you. Or keep them from voting.
Or keep them distracted.
Yeah, keep them distracted.
With other things.
Yeah. All right.
All right.
See you next week.
See you next week. Okay.
You've been listening to Forward with Falk. Longtime Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen discuss politics. Join them again next week, same time, same place.